Jaya Radha Madhava Punjabi Hari. Jaya Vishnupada Paramahansa Padavadikacharya Stotra Saptashishi Mata's Divine Grace Sesi Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON BVD Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Guntharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Gopamanandi Hari Hari Bo. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, second canto, chapter 7, text 3. Jajne chakardama grihe dvija deva hutyam. Judge ne chakardam agrihe dvija deva hutyam. Stri bir samam navabir atma gatim swamatre. Stri bi samam navabir atma gatim swamatre. Uche yayatma samalam guna sanga pankam. Uche yayatma samalam guna sanga pankam. Asmin vidhua kapilasya gatim prapade. Asmin vidhua kapilasya gatim prapide. Judge ne chakardam agrihe dvija deva hutyam. Stri bi samam navabir atma gatim swamatre. Uche yayatma samalam guna sanga pankam. Asmin vidhuya kapilasya gatim prapide. Vaishnavis. Jagne took birth. Cha also. Kardama, the Prajapati name Kardama. Grihe, in the house of. Dvija, O Brahmana. Devahucham, in the womb of Devahuti. Stribi, by women. Samam, accompanied by. Navabi, by nine. Atmagatim, spiritual realization. Swamatre, unto his own mother. Uche, uttered. Yaya, by which. Atmasamalam, coverings of the spirit soul. Gunasanga, associated with the modes of nature. Pankam, mud. Asmin, this very life. Vidhuya, being washed off. Kapilasya, of Lord Kapila. Gatim, liberation. Prapide, achieved. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. The Lord then, if this is Lord Brahma speaking, the Lord then appeared as the Kapila incarnation, being the son of the Prajapati Brahmin Kardama and his wife Devahuti, along with nine other women, sisters. He spoke to his mother about self-realization, by which, in that very lifetime, she became fully cleansed of the mud of the material modes and thereby achieved liberation, the path of Kapila. Purport. The instructions of Lord Kapila to his mother Devahuti are fully described in the third canto, chapters 25 to 32 of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And anyone who follows the instructions can achieve the same liberation obtained by Devahuti. The Lord spoke Bhagavad Gita, and thereby Arjuna achieved self-realization. And even today, anyone who follows the path of Arjuna can also attain the same benefit as Sri Arjuna. The scriptures are meant for this purpose. Foolish, unintelligent persons make their own interpretations by imagination and thus mislead their followers, causing them to remain in the dungeon of material existence. However, simply by following the instructions imparted by Lord Krishna or Lord Kapila, one can obtain the highest benefit even today. The word Atmagatim is significant in the sense of perfect knowledge of the Supreme. One should not be satisfied simply by knowing the qualitative equality of the Lord and the living being. One should know the Lord as much as can be known by our limited knowledge. It is impossible for the Lord to be known perfectly as he is, even by such liberated persons as Shiva or Brahma. So what to speak of other demigods or men in this world? Still, by following the principles of the great devotees and the instructions available in the scriptures, one can know to a considerable extent the features of the Lord. His Lordship Kapila, the incarnation of the Lord, instructed his mother fully about the personal form of the Lord. And thereby she realized the personal form of the Lord and was able to achieve a place in the Vaikuntha Loka where Lord Kapila predominates. Every incarnation of the Lord has his own abode in the spiritual sky. Therefore, Lord Kapila also has his separate Vaikuntha planet. Bet you didn't know that. That's interesting. The spiritual sky is not void. There are innumerable Vaikuntha planets, and in each one of them, the Lord, by his innumerable expansions, predominates. And the pure devotees who are there also live in the same style as the Lord, as his eternal associates. When the Lord descends personally or by his personal plenary expansions, such incarnations are called Amsa, Kala, Guna, Yuga, and Manvantara incarnations. And when the Lord's associates descend by the order of the Lord, such incarnations are called Shakyavesha incarnations. But in all cases, all the incarnations are supported by the invulnerable statements of the authorized scriptures, and not by any imagination of some self-interested propagandist. Such incarnations of the Lord, in either of the above categories, always declare the Supreme Personality of Godhead to be the ultimate truth. The impersonal conception of the Supreme Truth is just a process of negation of the form of the Lord from the mundane conception of the Supreme Truth. The living entities, by their very constitution, are spiritually as good as the Lord. And the only difference between them is that the Lord is always supreme and pure, without contamination by the modes of material nature, whereas the living entities are apt to be contaminated by association with the material modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. This contamination by the material modes can be washed off completely by knowledge, renunciation, and devotional service. Devotional service to the Lord is the ultimate issue, and therefore those who are directly engaged in the devotional service of the Lord not only acquire the necessary knowledge in spiritual science, but also attain detachment from material contamination and are thus promoted to the kingdom of God by complete liberation. As is stated in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 14, text 26, Mam chayo vyabhicharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samatichaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. Even in the non-liberated stage, a living entity can be directly engaged in the transcendental loving service of the personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna, or his plenary expansions like Ram and Nrisimha. Thus, with the proportionate improvement of such transcendental devotional service, the devotee makes definite progress towards Brahmagatim or Atmagatim, and ultimately attains Kapilasya Gatim, or the abode of the Lord, without difficulty. The antiseptic potency of devotional service to the Lord is so great that it can neutralize the material infection even in the present life of a devotee. A devotee does not need to wait for his next birth for complete liberation. Jai. Omagina Tamanandasha Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshurna Militamiena Tasmai Shri Gudave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitamiena Bhutale Swayam Upagaramayam Dadati Swapadantikam. So, as I mentioned right at the beginning, this is Lord Brahma who's speaking, and he's speaking about the Kapila incarnation. And he's describing that Kapila was the son of the Prajapati Brahmin Kardama and his wife Devahuti. So, when did this take place? Well, Kardama Muni is one of the mentally generated sons of Lord Brahma. So, he goes back to at least the beginning of this day of Lord Brahma. And Devahuti was the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu. Swayambhuva Manu was the first Manu. We are now in the seventh Manu. There are 14 Manus in a day of Lord Brahma. The day of Lord Brahma is 4.3 billion years long, and the night is the same length. So we're halfway through. Now we're about halfway through. We're in the 28th, isn't it? The 28th round, the 71 millenniums, and the Vaivasvata Manu. So we're about halfway through Lord Brahma's day. This took place, as I said, back in the Swayambhuva Manu. That's the first one. So that's almost about 2 billion years ago. So we're hearing something here that took place approximately 2 billion years ago. This pastime of Kardama Muni going off and performing austerities for 10,000 years. You know, Prabhupada said one purport was the beginning of the Satya Yuga. So they lived for 100,000 years back in those days. So he was performing austerities for 10,000 years. He was doing the Ashtanga Yoga system. He did it perfectly. Actually, Lord Vishnu appeared to him. Lord Vishnu appeared to him. And he asked for the benediction of a wife of like-mindedness or something. Exactly, kind of like that. Anyway, he was given the instruction by his father, Lord Brahma. He wasn't totally in Maya. He actually was instructed by Lord Brahma to increase the population, the good population in the universe. So he had a mission, and that to fulfill that mission, he prayed to Lord Vishnu as such. But anyway, so 2 billion years ago. Okay. So the next question would be to ask, where did it take place? Because Lord Brahma, he's situated in Satyaloka, right? And Swayambhuva Manu We know he rules, his place is Brahmavarta. And Prabhupada in one purport and some subsequent chapter, actually in the where this pastime is being described in the third canto, he talks about some authorities, I guess it's some of the commentators on the Bhagavatam say that Brahmavarta is, as I said, in Satyaloka, but others say that it has some relationship to Kurukshetra. So both Prabhupada just presents both opinions. He doesn't say which one is the correct one. Maybe they're both correct. Maybe there's some principle of correspondence there and somehow there's a relationship between the Brahmavarta here on earth and the one in Satyaloka. But in any event, the some other things were... at least from that alone, we can't tell where this pastime took place. But there's other bits of information, such as the where Kardama Muni was meditating. That was the Saraswati. It's mentioned that he was meditating by the Saraswati River. So the Saraswati River... is a river here on earth, at least was a river here on earth. Whether it has a heavenly counterpart like the Ganges, you know, flows throughout the entire universe, don't know. But anyway, once again, it certainly is a place that was here on earth. Further, it's mentioned that the place where Lord Vishnu came to when he was satisfied by his austerities was called Bindu Sarovara. So that's certainly a place here on earth in India, Bindu Sarovara. And also, elsewhere it's mentioned, well, in those chapters that describe this whole pastime, the third canto, that Lord Kapila eventually, after he instructed his mother, his father took sannyas, as you know, at some point. That was the deal, that he would just stick around for as long as it took to give her some children and a son, and then off he went, and he did what he said he was going to do. So Kapila Muni stayed there, and he instructed his mother, as we heard here. And after doing that, he also left, and he went to travel. And he wound up in a place, someplace where the Ganges River flows into the Indian Ocean, and called Ganga Sagara. And that's exactly where the Ganges intersects with the sea, or meets the sea. So that's here on earth. So most likely, it seems from every indication that this is something that, a pastime that took place here on earth from those different things. So is there some way, which brings us to the thing, well, hey, wait a second. This is saying that something took, this is describing an incident that took place between people, human beings, 2 billion years ago here on earth. So can we corroborate this? In other words, if we wanted to get more information about this, you know, can we look in the history books and find something about this? Well, the modern day history book, of course, is just Google it. But if you Google Devahuti or Kardama Muni or Swayambhuva Manu, what you get, at least the first website that comes up is Indian mythology. And it just proceeds to give you all the story, but without saying how it relates to the world, the Western worldview. And then there's the devotional things, like you get things from ISKCON and Srimad Bhagavatam, it pops up, and ISKCON Desire Tree, you know, but nothing what would be considered scientific, historical. I tried to research it in a different way. I researched the history of the earth, to see, you know, well, wait a second. Could this have been going on 2 billion years ago? What you find is when you read the Western worldview of what was going on here on Earth 2 billion years ago, this is what you get. According to modern science or whatever, 2 billion years ago, this is what was going on. Photosynthetic organisms enrich the atmosphere with oxygen. Life remains small and microscopic until 580 million years ago. So in other words, there was no life practically. I mean, there was, what there was 2 billion years ago was photosynthetic organisms enriched with that enriched the atmosphere with oxygen. And life was just microscopic until 580 million years ago. So complex multicellular life arose, developed over time, and culminated in the Cambrian explosion about 541 million years ago, which was a sudden diversification of life forms that produced most of the major forms of life seen today. Sounds kind of like don't match. Well, so where do the human beings come in the picture? Well, according to this, civilized human life, reading further on in the same article, it says, throughout more than 90% of its history, Homo sapiens lived in small bands as nomadic hunter-gatherers. As language became more complex, the ability to remember and communicate became better, and they were able to set up communities, and they discovered agriculture and da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, when, as a result of agriculture, they had access to food, and they were able to formulate societies. But that was 9,000, 10,000 years ago. See? So we're talking about this pastime took place 2 billion years ago. So according to the modern worldview, this couldn't happen. In other words, what we're getting here is a totally incongruous, incompatible, contradictory sort of picture of reality. So how do you deal with this? What I'm saying is clear so far? Okay. Well, one wonderful great devotee, his name was Sataputta Das. This was something he kind of thought about a lot, and he had something interesting to say about it. This is a book he wrote called Alien Identities. And in the introduction of the book, I'm just going to read very briefly a couple paragraphs. He goes, "For years I have been interested in the relationship between modern science," that's what we just heard there, that's the modern science worldview, "and the ancient Vedic worldview," the ancient Vedic worldview of India. Yeah. "I have been particularly concerned with the contrast between the mechanistic model of life developed by modern science and the animistic, or in parentheses, soul-based conception of life that lies at the foundation of the Vedic philosophy. The scientific model of life is based on experiments and careful reasoning, but by reducing life to a combination of atoms, it deprives it of all higher purpose and meaning. It reduces human values to behavioral patterns produced by cultural and physical evolution. These behavior patterns are contingent on accidental historical circumstances, and they have little to do with the fundamental nature of things." That's clear? Everybody's able to... He expresses himself a lot more sophisticated way than I'm able to, but I can understand that. I can't speak like that or write like that, but I can understand what he's saying. Can everybody understand what he's saying here, pretty much? Yeah, okay, good. All right, so one more paragraph. He says, "In contrast, the Vedic philosophy gives meaning to life by linking it with a transcendental level of reality. But in the process, it brings in phenomena, such as like reincarnation, and categories of being, demigods, and et cetera, that have no place in the theoretical picture of modern science." Here it comes. It says, "This naturally gives rise to the question of where the truth lies." Da-da-da-da, that is the question. He says, "Has modern science given a complete outline of life's fundamental principles? Or has it perhaps given only a detailed but narrow account of certain limited aspects of life?" Then skipping ahead, that was the introduction I'm reading from. And his last two sentences in the book, he says, "The teachings of the ancient sages are still available." Here they are, everybody. Lord Brahma, Narada Muni, Srila Vyasadeva. These are the teachings of the ancient sages. They're still available. $200 for a set. No. But they're still available. "The teachings of the ancient sages are still available, but they have become eclipsed by the modern developments of materially oriented science and technology. But he says, perhaps the time is coming when they will again be taken seriously. Well, we certainly hope so. And that's what this movement's meant. That's the purpose of this movement, to get people to once again take the teachings of the ancient sages, the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, seriously. And of course, he's correct. They have become eclipsed by modern developments in materially oriented science and technology. But that's where, you know, the Krishna Conscious Movement comes into the picture, where hopefully, you know, by distributing these books and our Sankirtan movement, we're going to be able to usher in a new era when people once again take these teachings seriously. Now, getting back to these couple questions he asked here, because this is, you know, before we go any further. So he asks the question here, he says, after he says, where does the truth lie? He goes, has modern science given a complete outline of life's fundamental principles? Okay, well, what do you think? Has modern science given a complete outline of life's fundamental principles? Raise your hand if you think so. Come on, what do you mean? We've got so much good stuff here. What, and nobody? Well, how many think that modern science hasn't given a complete outline of life's fundamental principles? Raise your hand. That's everybody. Yeah, right. What's the most fundamental principle? I was trying to think, well, what's the most fundamental principle? Yeah, consciousness. Consciousness. And, you know, as he mentioned, Sariputta mentioned, the Vedic philosophy is an animistic or soul-based or a consciousness-based worldview. So the most fundamental principle of life, consciousness, they haven't. They say that consciousness arises at a mature stage of biochemical development, and they haven't proved that. And there's even evidence, empiric evidence, that contradicts that, such as children remember their past lives, which Prabhupada never really made a big deal out of, but he did mention it on a few different occasions. I've heard it in lectures that he gave. You know, he just mentions it and goes on. That kind of evidence wasn't very important to Srila Prabhupada. That's not this tradition. Near-death out-of-body experiences, which are being studied by scientists now. So there's evidence that contradicts this idea that consciousness is something that comes about at a mature stage of biochemical development. But anyway, so they haven't understood it. That's the point. They haven't understood. They haven't given us a complete outline of life's fundamental principles. Now, the next question he asks is kind of following on from the first one. He says, or has it perhaps only given a detailed but narrow account of certain limited aspects of life? How many think that modern science has only given us a detailed but narrow account of certain limited aspects of life? Raise your hand. Yeah, right. So I'll go with this. That's exactly what's going on. So, you know, it's good to kind of be aware of this, because at some point we have to make a decision. You know, as devotees, you got to kind of, you can't just sweep this stuff under the carpet and, you know, close your eyes like the ostrich and stick your head in the sand. You know, you got to confront this. Hey, we're dealing with a very different picture of reality, but we're okay with it. I'm comfortable with it. You know, I'm comfortable with that 2 billion years ago, Swayambhuva Manu brought his daughter to marry Kardama Muni, and, you know, this pastime took place. I don't feel like, I'm in trouble now because the scientists say this. And no, we're going with Krishna consciousness. You got to choose. It's like, you know, it's like 1 foot on the boat and 1 foot on the dock. And the more you study and the more you learn different, you know, you realize, hey, these two worldviews, they're not synchronistic. They're not, you know, they don't kind of go together. It's, at some point, you got to make a decision. Which, am I staying on the boat? Am I jumping in the boat or am I staying on the dock? So we're jumping in the boat. The boat is the lotus feet of Krishna, the instructions, the knowledge we're getting from the guru and the Parampara, the cyclic succession, and we're going to cross the ocean like that. So just since we mentioned about soul-based, you know, animistic or soul-based or consciousness-based worldview, I'm going to read a couple lines from the Bhagavad Gita. But, you know, practically speaking also, let's aside from, well, let's look. There's different ways you can evaluate which worldview is better. One way you can evaluate which worldview is better is which one offers a better life. Okay? Because ultimately, you know, Vedanta Sutra says, Anandamaya Abhyasat, the soul is always hankering after pleasure. So even the non-devotees will acknowledge it. Yeah, happiness. We want to all be happy. That's the idea. The better worldview, the better life is the life that enables you to be happy, satisfied, fulfilled. The more happy, the better. And the longer, the better. Okay? So what does the mechanistic modern science worldview have to offer in terms of happiness and satisfaction? Well, when you're young, it could be great. If you got the karma, it can be great. There are I do meet young people out there that, you know, seem to have some good karma. They have, you know, they look good and they have some money, and you know, you could have a nice car and a nice girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, you know, and nice place to live. But you know, the body does get older, and when you get older, you're not happy. You can't be in the material world. I mean, once again, it depends on your karma. Some people will be able to enjoy material life longer than others, but ultimately, the body poops out on you. And so it's very limited, you know, the happiness that's there. But if you go with the consciousness-based worldview, the happiness that's offered is Sat Chit Ananda. You know, I heard Prabhupada explain that just yesterday. I was listening to a lecture, and he was talking about spiritual life. The experience is sat, means eternal, blissful knowledge. That's the happiness that's possibly available for somebody if they're successful in executing their spiritual life. Eternal, blissful knowledge. So, and here's what Prabhupada has to say about this, and it's better, you know, what you hear from Prabhupada's words. Right in the Bhagavad Gita, this is not like some advanced teaching. This is, Bhagavad Gita is like ABC, right? Okay, so here's what Prabhupada said. He says, as far as the soul is concerned, there is neither birth nor death. That we have discussed in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. Birth and death apply to one's embodiment in the material world. Fear is due to worrying about the future. Here it comes, this gets really encouraging now. A person in Krishna consciousness has no fear because by his activities, he is sure to go back home, back to the spiritual sky, back home, back to Godhead. Therefore, his future is very bright. Others, however, who do not know what their future holds, they have no knowledge of what the next life holds, so they are therefore in constant anxiety. That's not an exaggeration. You know, I mean, if you go out on Sankirtan, you meet people and you kind of chat with them, this is there. You'll get firsthand experience of it. Okay, therefore, they're in constant anxiety. If we want to get free from anxiety, then the best course is to understand Krishna and to be situated always in Krishna consciousness. In that way, we will be free from all fear. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th Canto, Chapter 2, Text 37, it is stated, Bhayam dvitiya biniveshita syat. Fear is caused by our absorption in the illusory energy. But those who are free from the illusory energy, those who are confident that they are not the material body, that they are the spiritual parts of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and who are therefore engaged in the transcendental service of the Supreme Godhead, have nothing to fear. In other words, if you follow what Prabhupada said here in the end of the purport, Mam chayo vyabhacharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samatichaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate, that if somebody, you know, places that makes a decision to place their faith in this worldview, this soul, animistic, soul-based philosophy of the, you know, Vaishnav tradition, okay, and you wholeheartedly engage in devotional service, as mentioned in that verse, then sagunan samatichaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate, you transcend the three modes of material nature, you come to the spiritual platform, the Brahman platform, and you experience a life, eternal life of blissful knowledge, like that. So Prabhupada goes on to say here,
Their future is very bright. This fear is a condition of persons who are not in Krishna consciousness. Anyway, that's basically it. So, yeah, you know, we choose this, and that's what we have to look forward to. And that's what we can also even be, what does people look forward to it? We could be experiencing it even now. If you're serious, if we, you know, at least that's Prabhupada's opinion. He says right here in the last two sentences of this purport, he says, the antiseptic potency of devotional service to the Lord is so great that it can neutralize the material infection, here it comes, even in the present life of a devotee. It's not like you got to wait till you die and go back to the Godhead before it gets good. It could be good now, here, right now. That's what Prabhupada's saying, right? In the present life of a devotee. Last sentence, he emphasizes it even more. He says, a devotee does not need to wait for his next birth for complete liberation. Even in this lifetime, if we're serious, sincere and serious, you can be elevated to the spiritual platform even here in this lifetime. Now, upon hearing this, and this is the last thing I'm going to say, and then I'm going to stop. Upon hearing this, if you're feeling, yeah, okay, I've heard this before, the hype, you know, but it's tough. It's hard. I mean, I don't. But you have faith in Prabhupada. We're here because we have some faith in Prabhupada, but you might be finding it difficult. Well, an important thing to do, and this is why Prabhupada wanted us to read his books. You know, there was one lecture Prabhupada gave in Dallas. He said, he was talking about tapasya, and he said, you know, my devotees, they should read my books 2 or 3 hours every day. He said, that is tapasya. He once, a lecture he gave in Dallas in 75. So, because when you read the books, Prabhupada is a pure devotee, and he's a transparent via medium. And when you're hearing what Prabhupada writes in his books, you're going to get encouraged. I'm going to read you something here. This is from a couple sentences from the end of the Bhagavad Gita. Just to give you like a philosophical explanation of why it's important to hear from the spiritual master. Okay, got it. Okay. So it says here, it appears, this is talking about at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, Sanjaya and Vyasa are kind of talking a little bit. And it says, it appears that Sanjaya also, by the grace of Vyasa, could see the universal form of Krishna exhibited to Arjuna. No, it's the wrong one. Hang on, give me a second. I apologize. I'm looking for that purport where Prabhupada says how, you know, the spiritual master is the transparent via medium, but he says, but the experience is direct. And he says, this is the mystery of the Sisipuk succession. You familiar with that one? I can't find it. I found it in a different edition of the Bhagavad Gita last night. But that's the idea, so that he's the transparent via medium. So you take shelter of Prabhupada's purports, Prabhupada's words, that's Krishna. You know, like in one purport in the first canto, it talks about how the Srimad Bhagavatam is non-different from Krishna. It's Krishna. So what does that mean? Does that mean the book with the cover? Is that what's non-different? Is that what's Krishna? Is it the pages? Is it the ink? No, it's the message. See, and Prabhupada's, he's the transparent via medium. He's giving the message. So the message Prabhupada's giving is non-different from Krishna. You're associating with Krishna directly when you take shelter and absorb the, you know, hear the message from the pure devotee. So you'll get encouragement like that. And I'll give you an example. Okay, in the Bhagavatam, 8th canto, chapter 3, text 17. This is in the last paragraph, Prabhupada says, and this is like, example of how you can meditate on something in Prabhupada's books and get encouragement. Prabhupada says, only Krishna can deliver us from material existence. Indeed, he is always trying to deliver us. Ishvara sarvabhutanam hridayeshu arjuna tishtati. He is within our hearts and he is not at all inattentive. His only aim is to deliver us from material life. It is not that he becomes attentive to us only when we offer prayers to him. Even before we offer our prayers to him, he always tries to deliver us. Therefore, in that verse, he says, he's known as Bodhi Karunayan Namo Lalaya. It is the causeless mercy of the Supreme Lord that he always tries to bring us back home, back to Godhead. God is liberated, and he tries to make us liberated. But although he's always trying, we refuse to accept his instructions. Sarvadamam Pradichajam Mami Sam Marmai Kam Sananam Vrda. And Prabhupada says, but nonetheless, he has not become angry, at least not to date. He has not become angry. Therefore, he is known as Bodhi Karunaya, unlimitedly merciful in delivering us from this miserable condition of material life and taking us back home, back to Godhead. So that's an amazing paragraph. You know, you can meditate on a paragraph like that and get encouragement. In other words, it's not about us. It's not up to us. But you don't have to be a great scholar. You don't have to be a great tapasvi. You don't have to be a really healthy person or a really intelligent person or anything. It's the mercy. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is always trying to take us back home, back to Godhead. So that, at least for me, that helps me a lot. You know, I just try to meditate on that paragraph and just, you know, grab onto the lotus feet. That's, you know, grab onto the lotus feet of Srila Prabhupada, and by doing that, you're grabbing onto the lotus feet of the entire disciplic succession all the way up through to Krishna, and just, that's it. It's not due to our prowess. And if you're feeling like, I can't do this, it's too hard. No, it's probably just it's illusion. We can. All we have to do is just humbly and submissively accept the teachings. And we all can just go, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna. Who can't do that, right? So we can be successful. And when if you meditate on a paragraph like that, you can, it just makes it more and more, feel more and more confident, more and more encouraged that, yeah, I can be successful. I can be successful, and other people should be able to be successful too. Because Krishna is trying, Krishna's canvassing. That's what that's saying. Krishna's canvassing to try to help conditioned souls come back home, back to Godhead. So if the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself is canvassing, then how can we, you know, if we just cooperate, we just have to cooperate a little bit and everything should work out fine. So I'll stop there. It looks like I'm already over time, so I won't take any questions. Thank you very much. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Kijai, Srila Prabhupada Kijai.
Post, or is Swayambhuva his name?
Manus were post.
Yeah, so Swayambhuva is his name.